KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Puget Sound orcas are emblematic of our region, but their numbers here are dwindling. We're going to have an orca update that's coming up this hour, and just thanks to all of you who emailed in your name that sound of the day. You were all thinking birds. We actually don't know the answer, but a lot of you have talked about baby birds of some kind. Mary Lou says, today's sound is a baby barred owl calling to its mother for food. I live on Whidbey Island. I always hear the baby owls in early August. Well, it's a mystery to us, too, so we will check, and hopefully we'll have the answer for you tomorrow. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos has entered the world of journalism. Bezos purchased the venerable Washington Post company for $250 million. The sale price includes all of the Post's publishing businesses. Yesterday's announcement stunned observers. The Post is one of the nation's flagship newspaper companies. It's been owned by the Graham family for three generations. Bezos purchased the paper on his own, not on behalf of Amazon. It's the second major newspaper sale this week. The Boston Globe Company was recently purchased by the owner of the Boston Red Sox baseball team. What does the Washington Post sale indicate about newspapers, their health, and about the future of media and journalism? Joining me now is Hansen Hossain. He directs the Master of Communications and Leadership Program at the University of Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Marcy.
Why did yesterday's announcement surprise so many people in journalism?
It hit at the heart of all that's powerful and the legacy brand of journalism. Washington Post, the second most important journalism brand in the country after the New York Times. It just seems like this upstart from the provinces with this new money from the technology business is now moving into a place that was so sacrosanct for so many decades. As one blogger put it, the iceberg just rescued the Titanic.
From a business standpoint, a newspaper doesn't seem like it would be a great investment, and yet two of them have changed hands this week.
No, it's funny because some people even said that Jeff Bezos overpaid for the Washington Post at $250 million. You know, a couple decades ago, that would have been in the billions as a price tag. But I suspect that, these are people who at a certain age who recognize these organizations still have credibility and brand and legacy, and their points in their own careers where they think that there's something that they might want to attach to in having those organizations. So I suspect that there's a bit of a passion play here, but also there may be, at least with Jeff Bezos, there's a thought that he might be able to bring his own innovative thinking that he took to Amazon and other organizations and maybe try to fix the business model definitely broken.
Well, fix the business model. He was quoted, well, actually paraphrased in today's New York Times. They were talking to the current publisher, Catherine Weymouth, who is a member, I think the third generation of the Graham family, and she told the reporter that Bezos says he wasn't looking for any kind of profit in this, which would indicate that there's still some sort of status attached to newspapering.
There's definitely status. I mean, if you look at most of the bloggers out there when they're engaging in deep debate over some controversial matter, they're typically quoting a URL from the New York Times or the Washington Post. So we still recognize that the credibility.
Whoops, we just kind of lost your phone line, Hansen. I don't know if you can hear me, but we have lost you. We're going to take a break and try to dial back Hansen Hossain in just a minute here on Weekday. Hansen Hossain is back with us. You just, yeah, there's something, no.
The signals are a little bit spotty.
I just figured it was something about talking about the wonderful ideal of journalism that made your phone line go out there.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that journalism still matters, and really good journalism may matter more than ever as we get into this chaotic world where everybody's performing it. In fact, I think Jeff's open letter is quite revealing, although he says he's going to take a hands-off approach to running the Washington Post. He says that he believes that there's some innovative solutions that can be applied. And on top of that, it sounds like he believes the Washington Post is still fundamental to our democracy in providing that well-sourced, sober second thought that we don't seem to engage in very much anymore.
And that got me to thinking about the difference between a purchase of a journalism outlet like the Globe or the Washington Post by an individual as opposed to a multinational corporation. How is that different?
Well, I think it's a matter of influence. I think it's a matter of regulatory challenges. I suspect that had Amazon attempted to purchase the Washington Post, that the outcry would be huge, given that the Amazon, no matter how much it's beloved by it, the American consumer is quite controversial as a business model. But as an individual, as Jeff Bezos continues to, I think, exert personal influence over interesting issues such as gay marriage or innovation or space travel, this doesn't seem to be so unnatural. I think the reason why we're all paying attention to it is because he has acquired such a prominent brand that means so much to so many people in this country.
Well, I'm interested to contrast that with the owner of the Boston Red Sox purchasing the Boston Globe. And if you thought $250 million was low, he bought that for $70 million. That would be a fire sale price, I think. How are those two purchases different?
Well, there's a fundamental difference, first of all, that you're looking at a local owner of a local institution buying another local institution, and I think that might go over better in a town like Boston. Here you've got somebody who is a global thought leader, increasingly, who has really made his mark on the world, who's looking to do something different. And so journalism isn't necessarily his natural habitat, and certainly Washington is not. And so I think it reveals a bit of a shift in the way that he's thinking about doing things. He also recently invested in Business Insider, which is a blog, to the tune of $5 million. He's taking a hands-off approach to that as well. But I think he takes journalism seriously, or he likes to consume this kind of media, and I suspect that he thinks there's maybe interesting new ways to deploy it and reach the consumer, and the Washington Post is definitely open and ready for that kind of innovation.
Well, obviously, he's a pioneer of online retail, so the speculation, of course, is the digital future of this company in particular. We've been talking about the digital future of journalism in general for many years now as we watch outlets go from print versions part of the time to a combination of print and digital, or disappear altogether or be solely digital. And it seems that the problem as newspapers make that transition to digital is how to the word is monetize that they use. How do you make money off of this?
Well, they are making money. I mean, fundamentally, the challenge isn't really, it's not a readership issue. I think a lot of these organizations have more readers than they ever did. It's just that people aren't necessarily paying for it the same way. They still make more money off in print revenues as they do in the digital revenues. And the paywall around the Washington Post obviously brings in some money. I suspect, you know, there's a couple of things. First of all, a great model for where journalism is going is maybe the Guardian in the United Kingdom, which is doing very well as a global brand, not as a British newspaper, but as a global brand. A lot of American consumers go to the Guardian site now because they're breaking great news. And I suspect that you could actually take the Washington Post and make it less of a inside the beltway brand and make it more global and bring those kind of stories. Secondly, Jeff Bezos is very customer oriented. And I suspect that what he's going to focus on is reducing the friction between the customer slash the reader and the organization. And he may bring down those paywalls. He'll probably look for different ways to deliver that content in ways that we haven't thought of until now.
Well, it'll be fascinating to watch and fascinating to think about the future of journalism. Hanson, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Marcy.
Hanson Hussain's on the faculty of the University of Washington's Communication School. He directs its Masters of Communications in Leadership program. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Minutes past 10 o'clock. KUOW's environment reporter Ashley Ahern joins us with an update on what's happening with Puget Sound killer whales in a minute here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor organic garden supplies and hydroponics, featuring organic bison soil, sanctuary soils, and cutting-edge solutions, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
68 degrees and sunny in Seattle. Forecast says we're going to enjoy this sun all day with an afternoon high of 87. Tomorrow, Wednesday, is going to wind up mostly sunny again with a high temperature of 82. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1017. Expert gardening advice just about 20 minutes away.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Federal officials say a group of orca whales should continue to be protected under the Endangered Species Act. Some California farmers had asked that the orcas be delisted. Meanwhile, a new count of Puget Sound orcas shows the population on the decline. KUOW's environmental reporter Ashley Ahern of Earth Fix joins me now. Thanks
Hey,
for
Marcy.
Coming in. Let's talk about this case in California. Who were these Californians, and why did they want to delist orcas?
These were agricultural interests, farmers in the San Joaquin Valley, that were worried that because the resident orca of Puget Sound was listed on the endangered species list, that means you have to protect its food source, which are the salmon that use the San Joaquin River, among other rivers, of course. And they were worried that their water rights were going to be restricted to make sure there was enough water in the river for these salmon. So they argued that the resident killer whales of Puget Sound are separate from the transient killer whales. The killer whales you see in Iceland and around the world are different from the ones we see, JK and L pod, so commonly in our waters here in Puget Sound. And by arguing that, they were saying that actually the population of killer whales globally is doing really well, and you should not be concerned about these residents because they're actually the same whales.
Okay, and what did the federal government say?
NOAA spent a year reviewing this, and then their National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said, no, that's actually patently not true, and we are throwing out this lawsuit. And I have a piece of audio. I've done a lot of reporting on the resident killer whales of Puget Sound. I've never lived, being new to the Northwest, I have to say, I thought I was on drugs when I heard how people know these whales by their pod, not only their matriline, but the pod, where they spend their time. You know, there are all sorts of very vibrant websites documenting every sighting of these whales. And a community that really is hugely supportive of them and fascinated by them. And so the JK and L pods are the residents of Puget Sound. And these are salmon, these are killer whales who actually only eat, they prefer to eat Chinook salmon. So it's not just that they eat salmon, they prefer Chinook salmon.
Well, those
fattiest
are very
and
good.
Largest.
Yes, they're delicious.
Whereas the transients, the ones that you see all over the place, prefer harbor seals, marine mammals, actually, which is a pretty big difference, biologically speaking. And so, to make the argument that they're the same is just kind of not scientifically provable. And I spent some time interviewing a man named Ken Balcom, and he is sort of the grandfather of orca research in Puget Sound, I would say. He's been studying the whales for years and years and years. And this guy can tell the difference of each pod, not just resident killer whales to transient killer whales, but the JKs and Ls sound different to him. And I spent a really amazing afternoon with him and recorded him talking about these sounds as he was listening to the calls of the whales.
That real high frequency. That's K. That's one of the K whales. That mewing. So if you hear that out on the coast, you know that K pod's there. You hear like that little whistly sound. That's common in L pod. They do share some calls, but if you listen to them long enough, you can hear the difference between, you know, you'll hear, like, J's won't do any of those high mewings that K's do, but they'll do some of the other squawks and stuff, you know.
Well, I'm sorry, Ashley. I guess I've not spent enough time with orca calls because I can't really distinguish the differences.
Most of us can't, but thank goodness there are people who are so devoted to listening to these whales on the hydrophone, documenting their lives, basically.
So when we talk about the J, K, and L pods, the resident pods, how many whales are we talking about?
When I came on the job 2 years ago, the number was around 87. It's now at about 82 this summer. And it's obviously a hard number to get a hard line on. But
sure.
There is concern that not only is the number lower than it should be, of course, but it's also we've had the least number of whale sightings this summer of any summer since 1990. These are for the resident whales. So there was a recent blog post that highlighted that and looked at the numbers very closely.
Why?
The strongest correlation appears to be the strength of the Chinook run from the Fraser River in Canada. That is the ideal food supply, major contributor to the orca, resident orca food source. So when that number does not look good, which it's looking pretty bad this year so far, that spells trouble for the whales. And that means they're not in here in Puget Sound feeding. They're out in the open ocean going to try to find those fish.
So what has been instituted to try to help restore population, or at least protect the remaining few dozen whale that are left?
I mean, millions of dollars have gone to orca research and orca conservation. Most recently, there was some heartening news for orca supporters. $925,000 grant came from NOAA to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And that's to put an officer on the job, basically, an orca officer, if you will, who will be out there for 3 years. That's for the grant, the period of the grant. And that's going to be for education purposes, but also to protect these whales from vessel traffic, keeping recreational boats away from the whales when they're feeding in Puget Sound.
I know that there's been a lot of talk about trying to establish a minimum distance that both just pleasure boaters but also whale watching tours how close can you get to these mm-hmm. orca, in other mm-hmm. words, not spitting that out very well. But it seems that that's a difficult thing. I mean, if you sign up to go on a whale watching tour, you want to see a whale. So if yeah. you're at a certain distance, you're not necessarily going to see that whale, which would imply that those businesses don't have a big future.
Well, I think they just need to get better binoculars for their boats.
When will this officer start on the job?
Very soon. I believe the grant has been issued and announced. So next 3 years, we're going to have an officer on the job.
Now, related to all this real news about whales is sort of cinematic news. People may have heard of a documentary film that just hit theaters over the weekend. It's called Black Fish. And as I have not seen it, but as I have read about it, it's about the orca that are in captivity in the sort of SeaWorld type environment. Actually, I think SeaWorld is one of the places that is documented. And it's about why these animals have this really violent reputation when they're held in captivity.
Yes, and it looks at one orca in particular who's called Tillicum, and he was at SeaWorld, and he's the one that people will probably recall killed a trainer a couple of years ago. And this documentary filmmaker, Gabriella Cowperthwaite, has spent 2 years putting together this very powerful documentary about kind of highlighting the problems with keeping these whales in captivity and what that kind of does to their psyche, essentially. Interviews a lot of former trainers from SeaWorld and other marine parks, as well as Ken Balcom, the man I just mentioned, mm-hmm. who knows these whales so well, and others, Howard Burda from the Orca Network. That's our hometown organization following the whales.
You know, it's interesting just to think in general about these animals who we call killer whales for short. I'm sitting in a room with a quilt on the wall that has a picture of an orca because it's such an iconic image of our region. And I think that there's this affection for these animals. People, I know in Blackfish, they talk about the intelligence that you can see in the eyes of an orca and probably other large marine mammals as well. But then we call them killers, and there's this sort of demonization of them as well.
Well, having watched a killer whale hunt salmon, I mean, the killer name is definitely an apt description. They are highly athletic, powerful swimmers and killers, yes. But they're killing Chinook salmon. And, you know, if anyone's seen the transients hunt down a seal, that's a pretty brutal spectacle to watch. So, I mean, it's a harsh name, I think, but they're doing what they are supposed to be doing as top of the food chain predators.
Ashley Ahern is with EarthFix. She's KOW's environmental reporter. Always fun to have you come in and give us a little behind the scenes information.
Thanks, Marcy.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
There's lots more environmental reporting from Ashley on our website, kuow.org. 10:25, in a moment here, on the job in a boudoir photo studio, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Join KUOW for Bumbershoot, featuring 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend, with artists of all genres from the band Fun to 60s rock with the Zombies. More on the events page at kuow.org.
Up to 69 degrees now in Seattle under a sunny sky. It's going to be sunny all day. We should reach a high of about 87. And then overnight, a few clouds with a low of 59. Tomorrow, Wednesday, a few clouds in the morning, then mostly sunny in the afternoon with a high in the lower 80s. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1026.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. In the 1980s, women captured their seductive side at a glamour shot studio at the local mall. In modern Seattle, women are having boudoir pictures taken. Christina Mallett is the photographer behind Katrinka's Secret. Our producer, Katie Sewell, shadowed Christina on the job.
I don't want you to look at me. You can look down your body, you know, like, oh, there I am. Remember to keep your hands relaxed. Hi, I'm Christina Mallett, and I'm a photographer, and I shoot boudoir. Now I want you to lift up your chest and expose your neck. Pretend like there's a vampire in the room, and he wants to find the best artery. So lift your chin up. Really extreme. Oh, yeah. That's what we're talking about.
Why do you think women want to do this? Why do they want to have boudoir photography taken?
A lot of times because they're getting married and they want to do a groom's gift. Sometimes it's also because they've achieved some goal. I've had women that have lost like 100 pounds. But with the older clients, a lot of times it's purely just to celebrate themselves.
I'm Susan Hesselgrave, and I'm here because I wanted to give a gift to my husband. He's always complimenting me and telling me how beautiful I am, and this is a way of honoring that.
Now you're going to slowly turn your head from side to side so there's like a fly in the room, and you can only get him away if you turn your head. Perfect.
Is this something that you would have done in a different period of your life?
No.
Why not? And why are you different now?
I think when I turned 50, I changed. I just, you know, life starts shortening up and you start appreciating it more. And I started appreciating myself more.
Why do you think that happened?
I decided I was going to try new things. I didn't want to become boring. You know, I started dancing. That's how I met my husband. I'm still trying new things.
Now what I want you to do is pretend like you have loofahs on your hands. And we're going to exfoliate. And you're going to slowly exfoliate with both hands.
Both hands.
Yes, and you want to keep your hands at different spots in your body. There you go. Perfect. Okay, now look over this way towards the mirror. My sessions are really fun. There's nothing... give the camera some love. I don't do any of that. I try to basically distract my clients.
And what's it like for you as a photographer to go from shooting babies and weddings to half naked women?
It's great. I when I was shooting a lot of maternity, I always felt it wasn't my thing. But I think that this line of photography is a lot more fun because there isn't this sort of sacred, oh, you've got a child in there. Let's honor the child. It's more, let's bring it up a notch, you know? Let's get kind of crazy and show off. And it's not, you know, oh, mother, look at mother. Take your feet in the air and cross your ankles. Look at those runner's legs.
Yeah, no kidding.
Are you a marathoner?
Yeah.
Multiple marathons
in multiple.
A weekend?
Yeah, training for... to qualify for Boston, I hope.
Okay, so now you're going to do similar to what we did when we loofahed before, but now we're just focusing on the legs. Relax your thumbs just a bit, and just hold it right there. Okay, now go ahead and move them.
Now you're taking a lot of photos.
I am. I'm not really a planner. I don't have like a shot list that I go through with every session. I just kind of roll with it. And one of the things that makes my work successful is that I move around a lot. I make my clients move too, but I move a lot, and that allows me to discover all kinds of fabulous angles.
And how do you feel as the photographee when she's clicking that much?
I kind of don't even notice it. I don't feel very self-conscious being photographed this way. Strangely enough, you'd think I would feel even more self-conscious, but if you're taking a photograph of my face, I do feel very self-conscious. But my feet?
You did take some of your face.
Yes.
But you don't know when I'm taking pictures of
no,
your face.
No, because I'm not trying to, you know, say cheese and please my mother.
Your mother would be very pleased with you today. Okay, now put your feet on the bed. Perfect.
There are several other boudoir photographers mm-hmm. in the city, and it seems like 10 years ago you wouldn't have heard of it at all, and now you do hear about it. It's like something people do, so why? What happened?
I think a lot of it just has to do with women feeling empowered, and they might not be a supermodel, but damn it, they can come to me and I'll make them feel like one.
Why is it empowering?
Well, first of all, you're in your skivvies, and at the end of the session, you're comfortable in your skivvies, and you kind of forget that you're not wearing a lot. After the fact, that's got to be pretty empowering. Regardless of the, you know, the way the woman looks, her shape, her size, what kind of lingerie she wore, every person I look at, I see something about them that I think is just amazing. And I think that when I have my camera in front of my face, I can really capture that. I mean, I can photograph anyone. I mean, I've had women who don't feel empowered, but they want to see themselves through somebody else's eyes. And when they, you know, I get a lot of emails where people are like, you know, I finally see now what my husband or my partner has been telling me is so beautiful about me. Thank you so much. What a huge gift. I mean, that's empowering for me too. It makes me want to keep doing this. Sometimes, you know, I'm like, I photograph naked women, you know, there are people starving in the world and there's, you know, Darfur, you know, there's all these terrible things going on and look what I'm doing. But I think from the surface, it could look like it's sort of petty or, you know, it's just about vanity, but it's really not. I think it's really about women accepting themselves how they are, and not only accepting, I think celebrating.
On the website, it says that you retouch them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean, and why do you do it?
I adjust color and contrast. I don't ever remove scars or anything like that, and part of it is that I don't want my client to see their proofs and think, oh, they took that away, or she took that scar away, or she took that mole away. That must be a really unattractive mole or scar. Maybe I should consider, like, getting rid of that. I don't ever want to give somebody a complex, and I think if I did that, that would be really bad. Okay, hop on that chaise there.
Okay.
Stretch your legs out a bit. Okay, now I want you to put your hands up above your head and just kind of lay back. So let your neck fall. Well, that wasn't successful, was it? Okay, how about move down a little bit, because you look uncomfortable, and we don't want you to look uncomfortable. Okay, perfect.
It's half the battle as a poser knowing what to do with your face.
That is sort of usually how I feel when I'm being photographed, is should I look more excited?
Is this a really happy
or no, this is a funeral. Calm down.
Is there anyone that you photographed that's particularly memorable?
Oh, yeah. We had this really beautiful client, and she was between 60 and 70. I can't remember her exact age, but she used to be a ballet dancer. And she was really confident. We had her dance in the studio, and images were so beautiful because she had like a piece of fabric, lowered my shutter speed, so it was there was a little bit of blur, and it was just really gorgeous. She was such an unconventional client. You know, you would never expect a woman who's 60 years old would come in and be so proud of herself and, you know, and beautiful, because she was so proud and confident. I hope I'm like that. Now I want you to slowly turn. So just keep going, and then stop. I thought that was really pretty.
So what is the name of your brand?
Katrinka's Secret, and that name comes from when I was little, when I would do something bad. Like, for instance, one time I tried to flush a brush down the toilet, and I got in trouble, and I said, Katrinka did it.
Something that you pulled out of the air?
Yeah. It sounds so exotic, and, you know, people might think I'm, like, you know, Russian or something, but I'm just a girl from Redmond.
That was KUOW's Katie Sewell.
Well, if you're a gardener, you're probably enjoying a bounty of vegetables around now, or maybe you're welcoming the later summer bloomers that are filling your beds in the garden. August is a great time to reap the garden's benefits, but truly, you know, gardeners, the work is never really done. It's Tuesday, and part, two-thirds of our Green Days gardening panel is here to answer your questions and your calls to 206-543-5869 or emails weekday at KUOW.org. Greg Rayburn, Vashon Basin Steward, co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk, and Marty Wingate, who writes about gardens and travel at MartyWingate.com. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
And I just have to say that in the last hour, we played our usual sound of the day, and it was kind of a mystery sound.
Yes, I couldn't recognize
it. Well, we have had many people emailing in, and most of them believe that it's baby bird that we heard.
You don't think it's here. The funny sound? Oh, so it's not a squirrel, no.
You hear the ferry boat in the background. Greg, you should recognize that.
Yeah.
What is it, Greg?
What's this bird, Greg?
Oh, it's not a bird. It's the sound I make as I walk around my yard and see another weed.
Well, we heard from, let's see, A. Anderson. He says, without having a clip to compare, but given the tree location, my best guess is a great blue heron with young in the nest. Gita writes, I live in Port Townsend. This morning's sound is a sound I often hear. I've traced it to a towhee living in the trees, the sound of a youngster screeching in the evening. Samantha says it's a stellar jay. Mary Louise says it's a baby barred owl calling to its mother for food. I live on Whidbey Island. I always hear baby owls in early August. We get one email from Nora. I think it's a stellar jay. Shannon says, I'm pretty sure it's a northern flicker. Hafizula says it's an owl, and Linda says it is a blue heron, maybe. So
wow.
I think it's really, we know it's a bird.
Consensus.
Yeah, sort of. It's a bird. Well, we're talking gardening, and I have noticed after my lobelia died, everything else is sort of happy right now. This is sort of that turning point, August, between the early midsummer stuff, and now we're starting to see, particularly when it comes to flowers, the later flowers of summer.
Yeah, it's a great time to figure out if you have too much going on in spring and not enough going on now, or vice versa. Now, we have a bed that is strongly mid to late summer, which I love, but I could put some more bulbs in there, I think, for earlier on. The Lobelia tupa, speaking of Lobelia, but of course not the little container Lobelia, this is a huge shrub-like thing, has started blooming in the last couple of weeks. And the hummingbird buzzes around for a while waiting for the first flowers to open. He gets really nervous about it. But so now the hummingbird is out there constantly. And the California fuchsia, which I have in a big pot, and I believe it has rooted through the bottom probably, turns into a monster at this time of year. And it's just now starting to bloom. There are loads of flowers for late summer.
And what's in your garden right now, Greg?
Well, I have a little bit of the lag right now, but because the goldenrod just hasn't quite come out yet, and the asters haven't started blooming.
No, they haven't.
Yet, but that'll be my next wave. So this time of year, I really like to enjoy some of the fruits. Fruits, I think, are very decorative. I mean, they add a lot of color. And
they taste good.
Yes, exactly.
Which is always fun. Well, what is in your garden? And do you have a question about how to deal with that? You can call 1-800-289-5869 or 206-543-5869. Email weekday at kuow.org. And as always, people send these emails in hours ahead of time. Dana says, I have a question. I'm interested in planting rosemary that will grow large enough to be a shrub. Is there a specific type of rosemary that would work best? I'd also like to use it for cooking. And when is the best time to plant?
Well, rosemary will grow. Many cultivars of rosemary will grow into
large shrubs.
Yeah,
yes.
3-4 feet high if they're happy. You want a really, really well-drained spot. And they grow in anyone's garden around here. And then that winter will come. So to be prepared for that winter, you might want to put the rosemary up against a protected wall. That's just all I'm saying.
So what are you saying, that it goes down to just a certain temperature in the winter?
Yeah, they get burned. That's what it looks like in really bad winters. Mm-hmm. And some of them will die, but I think that that may even be more due to the soil, the drainage, than the cold. So,
well, I thought that they liked really horrible soil.
Yeah.
I mean,
they're but it has to be well drained, not clay soil, not horrible clay.
So
horrible sandy.
Horrible sandy soil,
yeah.
And warm and with sun.
Yes.
Dry sun.
Dry sun. Phone number 206-543-5869. Valerie in West Seattle says, hi, I live on a small Seattle lot, and I have a neighbor whose bamboo has started to become gradually more invasive in the past 2 years. The shoots are coming up in random places through my lawn. They're nearing a flower bed, and it's even come up right next to my foundation of my house. The neighbor says she might have to use poison to stop this invasion. I have a young child and a pet. I've been gardening organically for years. Do you have any suggestions or where to go for help? I don't have funds to do anything terribly expensive.
Yeah, bamboo's a really tough one. It has those long rhizomes that allow it to head out for super long distances and then pop up. So really providing a barrier between the property, that can help. But you're looking at a lot of grubbing out. This is a good project to work on during the winter months. That's when I like, when the soil's nice and moist and you can really follow the roots.
Does it go down or sideways?
It goes mostly sideways.
It goes down and then it goes sideways.
Yeah. I haven't, my experience rooting, digging up bamboo, I haven't found the roots. If they hit a barrier, they might go down for a ways. I mean,
and then under and up?
Yeah. Well, but when I planted bamboo in a 55-gallon drum that was cut in half, that was a plastic one.
Did that work?
And it worked as far as depth. It was, a couple feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was the mulch built up over the top, and it sent this one little tiny runner right over the top under the mulch. And then once it hit the ground, it didn't show up again until 20 feet away.
Mm.
It popped up. So I had no advance warning, and by then I had this huge length of runner.
Yeah, so if it's your neighbor's bamboo, I would think that if possible, this isn't expensive, but it is timely, digging a moat along the property line,
mm-hmm.
so that you're controlling the bamboo when it comes into your property. And if you dig a moat, what do you think, a foot down or something?
Yeah.
Fill it with rocks. You're able to then monitor, I think.
Well, if you're going to dig that, you might as well put in a barrier.
Yeah, that's true.
So put in your bamboo barrier,
and then you can start getting it out of your side.
Exactly.
Is there a false bamboo that looks like bamboo that doesn't spread? If you want the look of bamboo,
the false bamboo—that's another name for Japanese knotweed.
Oh, that's worse than bamboo.
Nandina is called heavenly bamboo,
yeah.
And there are some tall varieties that grow about 6 feet and are lovely.
And there are some clumping bamboos.
Yes,
that don't,
Fargesia. Yeah, yeah,
they don't run.
I mean, if you like that sort of grassy look, but you don't want to deal with this, because this sounds like you don't want to deal with bamboo.
Well, some people know how to handle it, and they do. And then you may move into a house where you inherit bamboo, and then you don't know how it's been taken care of. So all sorts of things can happen.
That'd be a real estate deal breaker for me. But grow it in a container is another way to do it. We have a container with bamboo, and it's quite nice.
Bamboo or fruit or flowers, questions for our Green Days panel, 206-543-5869. Sandra in Olympia, thanks for holding. You're on the air. Sandra?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay, my question is about blueberry bushes. I have 3 blueberry bushes I planted about 7 years ago. They're 2 different varieties. I think the one in the middle is called a Patriot, and I can't remember what the one on either side is. They keep growing. They've gotten bigger, but I never get hardly any production, and the only production I do get, for the most part, is on the middle bush. The other two don't do anything. And maybe I'm only getting like a pint of blueberries a year.
And how old are they?
They're about 7 years old.
Wow. Yeah, that's... are you fertilizing or watering?
Both. I don't water as I was thinking about putting them on a. I have a drip system throughout our yard because I do a lot of gardening, both vegetable and flowers. And I don't have the drip system extended over there, but I do, you know, go over and you know, pour buckets of water on them every, you know, probably once a week or so. I do fertilize them with a, you know, like a fertilizer that I put on all the established plants in the spring.
That, depending on what the nitrogen level is in that fertilizer, that might be where you, a good place to start is to cut back on the nitrogen, because you might be supplementing new growth at the expense of getting fruits.
Okay. We do live under fir trees, so it's pretty acidic soil. I've got several fir trees on the property.
Well, it sounds like you're doing things right as far as the watering. I mean, it sounds like they have ample water, and they also have acidic soil. Now, how much sunlight do they get?
Not a whole lot. They get morning light, probably hour of good light, and then it's dappled after that.
That's it right there. They need full sun. Yeah, there is a variety. It's semi-evergreen to evergreen. It's sunshine.
Sunshine blue.
Sunshine blue that can do pretty well in part shade. And they can survive in part shade, no problem.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's going to be what's causing your the lack of fruit production. So you might look for some strategic limbs that you can prune without taking out any trees that will increase the amount of light those shrubs get.
Okay.
Okay. Good
Thank
luck with that. Thanks, Sandra. We are talking to our Green Days Gardening panel on our number, 206-543-5869, or toll-free, 1-800-289-5869. And David, on Bainbridge, you have some solutions for bamboo?
Yes. I've had a lot of experience with it and the rhizomes and how far they can go out. The barrier that you really need is some of that metal flashing that you can buy at most home development stores or home improvement stores. It has to be at least 18 inches in depth or width, and you want to put that in as a barrier, probably on the fence line, in order to keep the rhizomes from going underneath it. That's a common way of keeping the bamboo in place. And then really, she's got to get out all the rest of those rhizomes that are going through her yard. And the easiest way to do that, or what I've done, is you dig up one section and then you just start pulling it up, and it just sort of zippers through the lawn. And you just got to keep pulling it up until you get to the end.
Wow.
It'll sometimes break off, but you've got to follow it all the way. You know, and especially if it's getting close to the house, I've seen houses where the bamboo actually has started coming up underneath the house and through the floors. So you really want to get rid of that as fast as you can.
Thanks for your call, David. So metal, he recommends actually a hard barrier that this bamboo cannot penetrate.
Bamboo barriers always look so lovely in the garden because they have to stick up above the soil level. Oh, how attractive.
And also, that was really good advice. And really doing it when the soil is moist will let you get a lot more of that rhizome and help it from breaking off.
Or you could get a couple of pandas.
Yes,
maybe. That's it. They can move here. Melissa says, we have two varieties of tomato growing in pots around our house this year. They're so far doing great. Lots of foliage, many flowers, even fruit. My question is, they've had green fruit on them for over a week now. None of it's turning red.
Well,
join the club. Is there any treatment tomatoes need to help with ripening at this point in the season?
No. You can take a look at the green fruit. These are probably not cherries because they start ripening faster. But if you take a look at the green fruit, it goes from kind of a medium to dark green, and then it starts to lighten. And if you look at the underside of the fruit and you see kind of a star pattern from the blossom end, you know you're on your way. That's all I can say. You know you're on your way.
Somebody once told me that you should stop giving them as much water and that encourages ripening. Is that just an old wives' tale?
Oh, there are different schools of thought.
And I wouldn't do that at this point. I mean, we're barely into August.
And so especially if they're in containers.
Yeah, at this point, I would stay with the regular watering. And then once we start getting towards September, if things aren't happening, then you can start looking at those green tomato alternatives.
Well, all I know is that my sweet million, which I was complaining about not setting fruit, has set more fruit, but it also has grown about 3 feet.
Oh, and, yeah.
You know, all of a sudden it went nuts. So it's happy right now. It likes summer. Hi, Anna in Seattle. Thanks for holding.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I am new to growing plants, and so I figured I'd start small with a terrarium. And I have three little plants. One is an aloe vera plant, one's a succulent, and then one, I don't know what it is, but it looks kind of like a coral almost in plant form. And I was wondering how much water to give these plants.
Well, sedums are usually pretty drought tolerant.
Okay.
So that usually doesn't need much water. And that's, so I'm not, and aloe vera isn't a thirsty plant really either.
No.
I don't know what the third one is.
So it sounds like you have a little collection of succulents in a glass. You don't have a top on this terrarium, do you?
No, this is topless.
Yeah. I would think that you wouldn't need a whole lot of water for those. And of course, the whole point of a glass container like that is that you have a top on it, you never need water because it provides its mm-hmm. own water. But as long as you have these in a nice sunny spot, you could just moisten the soil occasionally, I would think.
Okay. So every couple weeks, give it a little spray at the root.
Yeah.
Give it the finger test. Stick your finger down into the soil and see how it's doing. You don't want to keep, with those plant species, you don't want to keep it consistently moist. You want it to dry out, and then you water it again. So depending on the conditions, it may take a week or even longer.
Anna, do you live anywhere near Capitol Hill?
I do, actually.
Because I was thinking you could go to the greenhouse, the conservatory at Volunteer Park, where they have a lot of these kinds of plants, and maybe just ask one of the people who's taking care of them.
That's a great idea. Greenhouse Conservatory on Capitol Hill.
Well, do you know Volunteer Park where the art museum is? And there's the beautiful glass conservatory that's off to the north side.
That's a great idea. You can go in the cactus room.
Right. And they have lots of plants just like that. And somebody's in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably can tell you exactly what to do.
Great.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call. We're talking about plants of all types, and this is not normally your area of expertise. No. Not native and not outdoors.
Indoor plants I don't do well with.
Hi, Diane. You are on the air.
Good morning. I live in North Seattle near the Jackson Park Golf Course on a quarter acre with a lot of limbed up Doug firs and hemlocks, and it's sandy soil. As far as watering, this month of August is the doldrums for plants because I have sandy soil. I've tried watering with pressure-compensating drip emitters. I've tried soaker hoses. I've tried a sprinkler that sprays low around the base of the plants. I've tried one of those arching oscillating sprinklers that puts water high. And I still have parched plants where the water just isn't getting down to the roots. I need help with water.
What plants are they?
I've got just about everything you could think of. I have a number of native plants, including Mahonias, but I have some ornamentals. I'm a member of the Northwest Perennials Alliance, and so I do garden intensively.
It sounds like it's a soil issue rather than a water delivery issue. You've tried lots of alternatives. I think I would really focus my attention on building the soil and adding compost and organic matter if you're trying to create a more soil that will hold water better and also support a wider variety of plants.
Well, I'm on a first name basis with the Smith Brothers dairy.
Perfect.
Compost, you know, that comes from those cows. And I also then in the fall try and top dress with whatever the local wood chipper, you know, wood tree trimmer will bring to. So I try to balance some humusy things along with then something that will hold the water.
But August is still just really just a parched-looking month. Everybody's hanging their heads low.
Yeah, and native plants in August, I will say, many of them tend to look a little crisp normally, and so that's normal. And you may have already done this, but you might want to think about reorganizing your plants so that the plants that are going to look crisp anyway are together. And the plant, and so if you focus your mulching and soil improvement and watering in just one or two areas, as far away from those dug for roots as possible, I guess, then you won't have to worry about the plants that don't need water.
That's, yep. So compartmentalize.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you just have one ugly, crispy area?
Yes. I don't think Greg would say it was ugly.
No, Greg would say it's beautiful.
But yes. But crisp, you do agree with crisp, don't
yes,
you?
Yes. Okay. My Indian plum is already losing its leaves.
Yeah, and the snowberries look a little crisp, and the amelanchier and...
Yep. So, well, good luck with that, Diane. And maybe you should be planting more of those rosemary in the summer sunny, sandy soil. Yeah. Real briefly, Allison on Beacon Hill. You're on the air. Real brief.
Hi there, and good morning. So to get right to the point, I have an Asian pear tree that I inherited, and I've had problems with aphids and ant farming, and now I'm having all the fruit has gotten cracked. And I'm wondering why that happened and what I can do to prevent it maybe next season, because I'd love to actually have some Asian pears.
Cracked fruit can often be a result of inconsistent water. So that may be it. Are you supplemental watering at all?
Not very well, no.
Yeah, so it's more consistent watering would probably help with that in the future.
Good luck with that, Allison. And Judy in Issaquah says, I've got tea roses. They're healthy but too big. When should I cut them back and to what height?
Well, if they're... I've been known to whack a rose right about now, but you don't have to do it. You could wait until late winter. But by all means, if it's in your way and grabbing you every time you walk by the plant, then cut a few branches off now.
And that's fine?
Yeah, that's all right.
Okay. Marty Wingett writes about gardens and travel at martywingett.com. Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin Steward, co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Enjoy summer. I mean, that's all we can do.
Exactly.
Yeah. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. There's that little bird. Name that bird. You can email us. Our email is weekday@kuow.org. And it's a baby, we think. Or maybe not, because our listener Katie sent us that sound from Port Townsend. If you know definitively what it is, email us at name that sound in the subject line. We know already there's a fairy in the background. That's the thing that we can identify. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to do a little bit of post-election commentary. It's not going to really be post. We're only going to know some of the results by this evening, but we'll tell you what we do know. Also, Les Lane filling in for Vaughn Palmer, Robert Horton, and John Talton will be here, all coming up tomorrow on Weekday.
Weekday begins at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. It's 10:59. Today, President Obama is expected to give a speech in which he'll propose an overhaul of the country's mortgage finance system. We'll have specifics in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. It is National Night Out, which means some streets around Seattle will be closed tonight so folks can get to know their neighbors. Our question for you, what makes a great neighbor and or neighborhood? And who's the best or worst neighbor you've ever had? Tell us your story by calling 206-221-3663. Stories of Neighbors and Neighborhoods, 206-221-3663. Join us for that discussion. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.